This is the podcast for Modern Physics, Physics 2710, 10th of January, 2007. Okay, what did you find out from your reading, Jacob?
I don't know. The thing that I was reading about that I thought was most interesting was the black body radiation, but I didn't understand it very well.
We want to talk about black bodies. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's one of the little clouds on the horizon that we didn't understand with classical physics, but it also plays a lot of important roles in what we talk about in the future. So I think maybe we'll just put that on our list, and it might be the first thing we talk about. But what else? If initial reactions first, then we'll come back and talk about black bodies. Teresa, did you have any reactions from reading?
Well, several, just sort of struggling through it. But yeah, I mean, I looked at what they had on black body radiation in chapter one, and also electrodynamics, which I didn't even understand the problem. So
which problem are you talking about?
Well, they talk about, okay, black body radiation, but the electrodynamics problem, so they have difficulty with, you know, because in one frame it looked like magnetic field, yet another frame it could look like an electric field, and somehow this was a big problem.
Okay, we can talk about that too. Marty Lynn, did you want to say anything from your reading? I forgot to bring the dye. Mass disappeared?
It was by the...
Oh. Is that listed under... Okay. We might even add conservation of mass to the ones above, although we know it is not valid today. Is that the sentence? All right, maybe we should make a list of these things that we're gonna talk about.
Where were you reading that?
It's on page 3. Let's switch to the OMO, and I'll show it to you. It's right there, page 3. So let's make a list of stuff we want to talk about. Black body radiation. Let's see. Electrodynamics, is that what they called it? And conservation of mass. Okay, that's a good list to start with. Miles.
Jacob already took mine. I was also looking at the black body radiation. I didn't really get what was going on there.
Okay. Anything else you want to add to the list besides that?
Nope.
All right. Deborah, your turn.
Well, I went back because I was curious about that Michelson and Morley experiment, and so I did a little bit of research about that, and I have some questions specifically about that and the discovery of ether, or the lack of the discovery of ether, the proof that it wasn't there.
All right, those are excellent. That's an excellent list. Anybody want to add anything else? We'll talk about all those today. I said we'd do black body first, but maybe we'll preempt that and go to the Michelson-Morley experiment since we've got the video queued up. We'll watch a few minutes, 15 minutes or so of video. Let's start that. This is Mechanical Universe High School Adaption. This is because it's shorter, so it won't take all half hour. This is really important because we were sure it existed. It wasn't that Michelson and Morley were going to do their experiment to see if it existed. It was merely to prove what we already knew. Do I need to take... It wasn't a question of whether it existed or not. It was a question of, well, gee, we know it exists. Why don't we just measure it just to be sure? And that was kind of the motivation. But now he's talked about kind of a going back historically and philosophically, that ifs was an ancient concept. Do you remember to the ancient Greeks what the world was made of?
Stuff.
Four stuffs. Earth.
Water. Water. Earth.
Marty Lynn?
Light.
No, that wasn't one of them.
Mm-hmm. Wind.
Earth, fire.
Wind.
Water and air. Wind is air, okay. If you were in a high school chemistry class in 400 BC in Greece, there'd only be four elements on the periodic chart. Earth, fire, air, and water. And then you combine those and they have different properties and you get everything you see around us. Pretty clever. However, a very important philosophical point in the ancient Greek worldview also entails the fact that when you look up at the sky, things are different up there. If you look down here, stuff tends to go in straight lines. It belongs down, so it drops down. If you slide it across the tabletop, it wants to be at rest, so it comes to rest. It stops, slows down, goes in straight lines. And also you notice that things die and decay. The leaves fall off the trees, animals die, people die. Sometimes there's rebirth again in the spring, but still there's this cycle of decay and carnal, sensual, devilish, wicked, mean, bad, nasty, ugly stuff that all of matter is. Matter is bad stuff. But if you look up in the heavens, you don't see bad stuff. What do you see up there? Do you see stuff going straight lines in the heavens? You do not. Stuff goes around in circles. Do you see it change up there? You do not. Do you see any decay, any mortal stuff, any carnal, sensual, devilish stuff up in the sky? No.
Comets.
Comets, they're in the air. That's okay. They're the dividing line between the earthly, terrestrial, yucky stuff and the celestial, perfect, heavenly, divine stuff is the orbit of the moon, the sublunar sphere. And the comets obviously were changing. They saw comets. But yeah, that's okay because they're in the sublunar sphere. Are they really? No. But they thought so. They thought they were below the moon and therefore they were allowed to change and decay and break up or go away or whatever they wanted to do. But the truly heavenly stuff never changed. Therefore, if you see the universe divided into these two distinct realms, you might suspect that they're made of different stuff. Earth, fire, air, and water down here, and ether up there, the celestial heavenly ether. The fifth element, also called the quintessence, is what makes up the heavenly stuff. Now, to push this point one little leg further, they also figured, since you see different phenomena, and since they're made of different things, it stands to reason that different physical laws apply. Down here, we see things fall to the ground, and we could come up with some laws, but up there in the heavens, different set of nature's laws govern what goes on up there. I think we had this discussion last semester, so I hope you're remembering it. But the point today is that it's made of this ether that fills all space, that the celestial stuff's made of. And it's kind of a cool thing. It's perfect, and anyway, it's the intellectual antecedent of this luminiferous ether of the 19th century that was the medium that enabled light to travel from one place to another through empty space. It wasn't really empty. It was filled with this all-pervasive ether, and that's how light got around. And so that was the rationale. We knew waves needed a medium. All waves need a medium. And so there has to be something. Let's go measure it. And that's kind of the rationale, the motivation for this experiment. Okay, all I was going to say is that pay close attention to this part right here because they're going to explain why and how we expect to be able to measure the ether, and because the idea is that speed of light will be different in the medium when you go along the path. Let me back up and use an analogy. It's the old thing of if you have a river flowing down and you have banks on each side and someone swims from point A across the river to point B and back again, that it doesn't take the same amount of time to do that as it does to go downstream and upstream the same distance. So these two arms of the interferometer, the Earth's moving around the sun through this luminiferous ether, that's kind of creating this stream of moving medium. So the light beam that goes in the direction of the Earth's motion and back again has a different, it takes a different amount of time to do that than to go transverse or crosswise to the motion and back again, even though they might be the same distance. So you don't expect those two beams to get back together and interfere constructively. They might interfere destructively. That's the basic plan. But this little animation graph they're showing on how to compute that will be actually important in Chapter 2 as well. So pay close attention to this. A clever little point here, it's just kind of historical fun tidbit. Michelson was so good at this, his experiment is so sensitive. One part in 100 million, it's got to be pretty well designed and well built. It turned out it was so sensitive that if you walked across the laboratory floor, your footfalls would disturb the interference fringes of this gigantic experiment that was sensitive enough to detect your footsteps across the room. So he mounted this thing on a gigantic slab of stone and then floated it in a pool of mercury, because stone floats in mercury because mercury is very dense. And so the mercury was the insulating, you know, it cushioned the external, you know, the fans and stuff in the building and all the building noises and the footfalls. That's how sensitive this experiment had to be. And they should have seen the ether if it was there. Okay. Very, very important historically for the reasons elucidated in the movie. But interestingly enough, even though it shows that the ether did not exist, big surprise, and therefore the speed of light can travel the same for all observers, that becomes a standard pillar of Einstein's relativity, we are not even sure, we don't have conclusive evidence that Einstein even knew about this Michelson-Morley experiment in 1905 when he wrote the theory of special relativity. So logically, it makes a good story, and it ought to be that way. It should have been the case that Einstein looked at the Michelson-Morley experiment and said, oh, no ether, light doesn't need a medium, then I'll come up with my theory of relativity, explain it all. But we don't have any evidence that that, in fact, took place. So, interesting historical tidbit. Deborah, do you have any further comments or questions about the Michelson-Morley experiment?
No, that's pretty much answered it. A lot of the explanations that I read were talked about the different lengths of the arm, and I could not imagine how they, because the way that it was set up, they're exactly equidistant from the half-silvered mirror. So I didn't understand that, but that makes more sense.
Okay, and the point is, not so much whether it's a bright spot or a dark spot, because one mirror might be one half of a wavelength further away. I mean, it's hard to get that so precise, but it's not so much whether it's a light or a dark spot, but whether it changes from a light spot to a dark spot or vice versa when you rotate the apparatus. You have to run the experiment, then turn it 90 degrees and run the experiment, or 45 degrees and run the experiment, wait 6 months to see if you're on the other side of the sun, and you do all that, and still, if it's always the same, either bright or dark, doesn't matter which, then you've conclusively proven that there's no ether.
Okay, well, something else too, they actually measured it. I mean, they actually made measurements, and I'm a little confused as to what they were measuring.
Well, they were measuring the fringe shift. That picture in the video showed the bright spot and then the dark light, or the dark spot in the center. What they wanted to see was whether that changed when they rotated the apparatus. They did not actually physically measure the speed of light in that direction and the speed of light in that direction. They didn't do that in that experiment. Now, Michelson was famous for measuring the speed of light, as it mentioned twice in the video, but he did it with other techniques. This is not to measure the speed of light specifically in that direction, but just to see if there's a difference in the speeds of the two beams in those two directions, and to see if that changes when you rotate the apparatus around, and that would prove the ether.
In one of the articles that I read, it actually had a chart and showed several different experiments over the course of the years, all the way up to the 1950s. They were still trying to utilize Michael Morrison experiment. And even now, I think NASA is putting up some interferometers in space. Is that correct?
Yes.
And they're doing the same kinds of things, but now they're trying to measure gravitational waves?
Correct. LIGO, okay. The LIGO.
Right, but then when they summarized this chart, they actually had numbers that they were measuring. They said, this is what we expect, and then this is what we got. I'm a little confused.
Send me the URL and I'll look at it and give you a response.
Okay.
Any other questions from anyone else on this stuff?
I have one.
I have probably a historical question. Their idea of ether was, I mean, it had to be in their lab room or whatever, so it was, I mean, when they visualized it, it was like it could be in the earth, and obviously the air didn't affect the air, it wouldn't affect. So it was kind of like all present, all pervading, even through the earth. And
permeated everything. Yeah, it was everywhere. Yeah. No drag, though. It was totally non-viscous, but yeah, it was everywhere. In order for them to have seen any effect, it would have had to be inside their laboratory, in the air in their laboratory. You're right. You're right.
Well, there was also another scientist that did some experiments outside, and he just used a tent, like a tent, canvas tent, around, because that was the other thing. Well, they said if maybe it couldn't get to the walls or something like that, and so they did specific experiments that showed the same thing, but did it outside.
I didn't know that. That's an interesting comment. Okay, Miles had a question.
I don't know. I was wondering, it said it proved at the end that, or it showed that, not proved, that if you had two observers that were not stationary relative to each other, but there was a light beam going by or whatever, they both observe it going at the same speed. And I don't see how it showed that exactly.
I don't think they demonstrated that conclusively in the video. They made that statement, and it turns out to be true, but I don't think they proved it very well. However, we'll talk about that more in Chapter 2, and we'll see some more videos with the same animation that will do a better job of that. It is a rather startling assertion to make, though, to have two observers that are in relative motion compared to each other. Say this guy's at rest and this person's moving. You could also do it the other way, of course, but it doesn't matter. But at the time that they're coincident in the same place, then you emit a light pulse in all directions. You have a sphere of light waves, a wave front moving out spherically in all directions from that position. Each of them, if this relativity business is true, would say that light travels at the speed of light. It's the same for all observers. And so each of them would see this expanding sphere, and each of them would think that they're at the center of the expanding sphere, but they're no longer in the same place anymore. The light started when they got together. Here they come, light's emitted, goes out in spheres, but this guy keeps moving, and now they're both at the center of the same expanding sphere of light. That is weird, and we will have to address that next chapter. All right, well, let's go back to our list and see what else we need to talk about. How are we doing on time? All right, let's go to electrodynamics. How about that? This is page 17 of the textbook. It's talking about electromagnetic theory, Maxwell's equations. The previous paragraph is about the ether and the Michelson-Morley experiment, and says the other difficulty with Maxwell's equations has to do with the fields seen by moving bodies. Just a refresher of those Maxwell equations, they're back here on page, where are they? Here, on page 5. This is page 5. And that's the set I showed you last time, and you've now read the chapter and seen them for yourselves. Those equations describe everything we know classically about electricity, magnetism, and including light, because light is electricity and magnetism, it's moving fields. How are we going to get around the fact that these Maxwell's equations do not keep their same mathematical form under the Galilean transformation? Well, what in the heck is a Galilean transformation? Well, in the video, when you saw Galileo zipping by on the train, the idea was that you could simply add velocities. If Galileo throws the baseball, then the person on the roadside that's measuring this would add the baseball speed in the reference frame to the speed of the reference frame that's moving, and come up with the combined speed. It would just simply be an addition issue. That's Galilean relativity. But if you try to impose that condition on Maxwell's equations, find them again, on these equations, then they don't appear the same. The equations get screwed up. They don't appear the same way under a Galilean transformation. And so that's the issue. That's the problem. We have not yet come to the resolution of the problem. How are we going to fix that? But it is the problem. Now, Newton's laws, on the other hand, do obey this Galilean transformation. In Newton's Newtonian mechanical universe of just regular laws of mechanics, you can add those velocities. Galileo and Newton would have agreed on this. You can just throw the baseball and add that speed to the speed of the train, and that's the total speed. And the laws of mechanics are okay with that. But the laws of electricity and magnetism are not. So there's a little conflict we're going to have to iron out next chapter. So I haven't totally answered the question yet, Teresa, but does that more clearly state the issue?
Yes. I mean, because actually with Michelson-Morley, then you're saying because of theirs, they would stay the same. They wouldn't change
Well, the issue is...
They don't act like the Galilean transformation, so that would fix that, I guess.
Right. We would like the laws of physics to be the same, whether you're standing on the ground or on a moving train. In fact, we would really like it to be so nice that if you were in a smoothly moving train with no clickety-clack, very smooth rails, no doors or windows, then, and if it was moving at a constant velocity, we would like the laws of physics to be so the same that you couldn't even tell that you were moving at all. There would be no experiment you could do inside this closed boxcar to tell that you were moving. And you could perfectly claim that you're at rest and everything else is moving the other way. For that to happen, you know, for the laws of physics to be the same, then those mathematical equations need to have the same form. They need to look like the same equations to the person that's moving as they do to the person that's on the ground. The simple Galilean addition transformations do work for Newton's laws, but don't work, don't give you the same form of equations when you try to apply it to the Maxwell equation. So there's a conflict there. Are we going to keep Newton's laws and throw out Maxwell's equations, or are we going to do the other? We're going to keep Maxwell's equations and throw out Newton's laws. Either one of these would be painful because those are the two pillars of classical physics. Mechanics, electricity, magnetism. We also mentioned thermodynamics, but at its heart, it's an atomic theory of mechanics anyway. So these two pillars that the whole foundation of physics is built on, one of them is going to be undermined, and it's going to be painful. All right, these names right here were also mentioned in the video. Lorentz, the Dutch physicist, and Fitzgerald, the Irish dude. So we've got the Lorentz-Fitzgerald idea that things might contract in the direction of motion by just enough to make the light beams meet up again, by just enough to make all the laws work out. It would even make this issue go away. I mean, it would be okay. If everything contracted just by the right amount, depending on its motion, then the laws of electricity and magnetism can be saved. So it's a clever approach. Okay, but we'll come back to that, but we're going to leave it now. All right, conservation of mass. Let's talk about that for just a minute. So, conservation of mass. Historically, we thought mass was conserved. We had laws of conservation of matter, laws of conservation of energy, and they were different laws. But it doesn't always work out that way. That's about all it says in the book, because we know it's not always true. And it might have been hard to see this in the 1800s in some experiments because it's a small effect, but it's easy to detect now. If you take an electron and a positron and smack them together, they each have mass. You even know how much. I mean, there's a certain amount of mass that electrons weigh, and the positron would too. If you smack them together, they totally annihilate each other in this burst of energy, and the mass isn't there anymore, or the matter's not there anymore. You want to say it. The mass has disappeared. So it isn't conserved in those particle reactions of modern physics. We have to explain that. Why isn't it conserved? Where did it go? Shouldn't it be conserved? Well, Einstein addressed that as well in 1905, and that'll be also part of our discussion when we get to chapter 2. So I'm acknowledging that it's a question and an issue, but I'm again not giving the answer quite yet. Until we get to chapter 2. The last thing then, although nobody mentioned the ultraviolet, well, it's kind of related to this, is the black body radiation. One of my favorite questions to ask students is, part A would be, what is a black body? But that's not quite so fun. Part B is the really fun question. I like to ask students, why aren't black bodies black? Why aren't black bodies black? That's the greatest question. And it even becomes even better after you understand the answer to part A. What is a black body? And then you could say, why aren't they black? Would be a really good follow-up question. Why do we call black bodies black bodies? What are they? What's the definition of one? Anybody have a clue? Any starting point? Don't be bashful. I'll roll the die. 5. Okay, Teresa, that's you.
Yeah. Well, I thought it had something to do with it's some sort of object or hole or whatever that absorbs all radiation incident on it or that hits it.
That's precisely correct. Couldn't have done better myself. That's exactly right. Deb, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that. I don't really understand it either. It's just something that absorbs all energy.
That's right. You're both exactly right. If you shine light on a black body, it absorbs it. What would the other option have been? What do other bodies do that aren't black bodies? They might reflect it, and so black bodies don't, okay? It's either absorbed or reflected, but black bodies don't. They only absorb. They never reflect. Any kind of light, any amount, any color, you shine it on a black body, it's absorbed. Now, where do you get these? Do you go down to the massless string store and pick up a couple of black bodies? That's where they are, is in the massless string store, because there aren't any real black bodies. So it's one of these things that students really get mad at us physics teachers. Why are you inventing this idea when there aren't any examples of it in real life? What's the point of talking about black bodies if there aren't any? The answer is, there are a lot of things that are pretty good close approximations to black bodies. We can come up with a theory about black bodies and do mathematics on it and explain what's going on, and it does very closely explain the real object. Do we have any perfect black bodies? You'd be hard-pressed. You're not going to find any down at the store. Can we find things that are very close to them, very good approximations to black bodies? Yeah, I can show you some of those. Deb?
I was going to say, where did our idea originate? Who thought of it, and how did it come about?
That is a good question. I don't think my knowledge extends back in history far enough to be able to answer it correctly, but there are two people that are listed at the top of page 18 who have their name attached to the black body idea, Lord Raleigh and Jeans. They did some work on this. I don't know the first person to ever think about these. I guess I'm pleading ignorance to your question.
My question, it's more of, why would they even think about something like this? what spurred it? What was the driving force to go out and look for these bodies that absorb all the energy?
We need to answer part B first before we get to that. I think it'll become a little more clear. I have said that I can show you some examples of things that are close approximations to black bodies. We want to do that, and then I also need to ask part B of the question, and I think it'll kind of come all together and you'll get your question answered too. So the kicker question that I love to ask students is, why aren't black bodies black?
Because they're not real.
Good answer?
No. Good try, though. Oh, you didn't push the button, so they may not have heard you. Miles says because they're not real. Jacob?
Well, I guess just kind of what I'm thinking is, if you see something and see that it is the color black, there's actually some light reflecting off of it for you to see it. And if this absorbed all of the electromagnetic radiation, then there would be nothing to reflect back off of it for you to see it.
What color is... is night. It's black. If you go into a dark room with no windows and doors and turn off the lights, it's black. And it's black like a black body might be black. That is to say that when you see black things, it pretty much is the case that not very much light is reflected. Now, my black computer case right there in front of me, yes, there's some light coming off of it, and that would be kind of what you're referring to, that some light is still reflected. But I'm talking about really jet black, coal black, soot black type stuff. Doesn't reflect light, and it would be like a dark room. Why aren't black bodies black? Marty Lynn, you want to take a stab at this?
I was looking at the book, and it was talking about radiation is emitted
from black bodies. It has everything to do with it. That's the right answer. Black bodies are black if they're cold. But black bodies aren't black if they're hot. Why might they not be black? I mean, after all, any light that falls on them is not reflected, but rather absorbed. So why wouldn't they be black? Because they don't have to get light into your eyes by reflection. There's another way. The object might shine. It might emit its own light. And black bodies are permitted to do that. That wasn't part of the definition. When we said black bodies absorb all light that falls on them and don't reflect any, we never said that they couldn't shine. And hot black bodies shine. What else do you know about that shines? When you hear the word shine, what's the other word that goes right with it?
Sun.
Exactly.
Stars.
Yes. And those are very good approximations to black bodies. So maybe this is starting to answer Deb's question. Why do we care about black bodies? What motivates us to even think about them? Well, the sun shines, and black bodies shine, and the sun is a really good approximation to a black body. It shines because it's hot. Do you want to see another black body? I can show you one right here. In fact, you brought it with you. Everybody, take your hands, cup them together in a light, tight cavity. Take off your glasses and make the tiniest, tiniest hole there by your thumb there. Cover it with your eye so it doesn't leak in around your eye. And look in there. It has to be really good and tight. Okay? No leaks. No leaks. What do you see in there? What color is it? It's black! That's because it's cold. Now, if your hands were hot, would it be black? No, your hands would shine, and you would see light in there. But a cavity like that is another really good approximation to a black body. And it's black because it's cold. The sun's not black because it's hot. Now, our astronomy teacher, Mr. Lindsay, likes to do a demonstration with this, where he gets a metal ball on a handle and turns on the burner and starts to warm it up. It's all physics equipment, but you've done stuff like this at home. Back in the olden days when we had coil-top stoves in our kitchens, and you turn on the stove up to 10, the coil heats up. Is it black when it's hot? It is not. It gets to be red hot because it's shining. It's emitting light because of its temperature. Now, is it a true black body? No. It reflects a little bit of light even when the stove's off and it's cold. You can see those coils because some light reflects off of them into your eye. So no, they are not perfect black bodies. But on the glowing side, it's the same principle. It's still the real McCoy. It's the real deal. The object is glowing red because it's that hot. It's red hot. Have you heard that white hot is hotter than red hot? Have you heard that blue hot? We think of blue as a cool color. But blue hot is actually hotter than white hot. Things that glow blue are really hot. When's the last time you went out on a star party and looked at the sky and saw some stars of different colors? Have you seen different colored stars? And is that a mere optical illusion? It is not a mere optical illusion. In fact, it's really much more true than your eye even will tend to indicate to you, because your night vision is much less sensitive to color than your day vision is. And when it's dim outside and dark at night, your night vision's on. You can see light, but it's tough to see colors. So the fact that you do see different colored stars, even with your night vision, means that it's really a true pronounced effect, and that if you could see those stars with your day vision, you'd clearly see that they are different colored stars. What color stars have you seen?
Well, I've seen red. Antares is pretty red.
Antares is very red. It's a well-known, very big red star. Teresa, what color stars have you seen?
All the blue-white ones, yellow ones. How come there's no green?
It's a good question. There is a star that kind of looks green to me when it flickers, when it twinkles. But you've got a good point there. There aren't any we really think of as green stars. But there's an interesting double star in the constellation of Deneb, of Cygnus, the swan. Deneb's one of the stars. Constellation of Cygnus, the swan. The beak of the swan is actually a double star. It's actually two stars. It's a binary star system. And one of the stars is yellow, and the other star is blue. You put a telescope on those, you can't see this with the naked eye, but if you put a telescope on those, we call them the Cub Scout stars because the colors are yellow and blue. And it's very clear to see in a telescope. One's yellow and one's blue, right in the same field of vision of your telescope. Which one's hotter? The blue star. This is a black body diagram of the kind that's in your book. On page 17, figure 1.8, it's the same figure. Except this one's prettier because it has the colors marked on it to show where the visible range would be. So if this is red, what wavelength is just a little bit longer than red wavelengths? What do we call this? What do we call more than red? Redder than red is called Infrared. Right here. And what's purpler than purple?
Ultraviolet.
Ultraviolet would be over here. Okay?
Should call ultra.
So infrared and microwaves and radio waves would be over here. And ultraviolet and x-rays and gamma rays and stuff like that would be over here. This is the wavelength scale. Shorter wavelength, longer wavelength. Red is longer than blue. Just okay with everybody? Okay. So we can see it. We have three different graphs on here representing three different black bodies. Are black bodies black? Yes, if they're cold. But these aren't. These are hot. How hot is this one, this lowest curve here? What's its temperature? 3,000 Kelvin. The unit of temperature is the Kelvin. So this is hot. How hot is room temperature, by the way, in Kelvin?
Around 273 plus 20.
Okay. I round that off, really round numbers, because I just want to remember a ballpark thing. It's approximately 300. Okay? A tenth of this. Okay? So this is 10 times hotter than room temperature. This is twice as hot as that. And this is, four times as hot as the 3,000. So we're talking about three different black bodies, and since I got this transparency out of an astronomy textbook, then we're talking about three different stars. This is a red star. What color star is this? Well, it's kind of greenish-blue. And this star, this upper one here.
Yeah, there's Teresa's green star, whatever that one is.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. In fact, well, let me finish this sentence. This is the very hottest star. And the reason this one looks red, notice that the peak of this curve is not in the red. The peak is actually in the infrared down here in the bottom curve. But you don't see that. Your eye is not sensitive to the infrared. Of the colors you can see, which one do you see the most of? Red. And that's why this star looks red. There's twice as much red as purple. This star looks red. This would be the temperature of the surface of Antares. What's the surface temperature of the sun?
That's close to the middle one there, 6,000, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Teresa, you should have a lot of good facts tucked away in your brain. You're going to be very valuable to us. It's not quite 6,000, but very close. It's 5,800, which means that if we were to draw a fourth curve representing specifically the sun rather than just three old generic stars, where would we draw this curve? The new curve?
In the yellow part.
Right.
The peak in the yellow, wouldn't it?
There are two laws you have to remember when you draw this curve. Two main mathematical points to make here. One is that the 6,000 Kelvin black body emits more radiation than the 3,000 Kelvin black body at every single wavelength. That is to say, this curve is always above this curve. Now, we're assuming the two black bodies were the same size, because if you start with a giganto cool star, it could emit more light than a really tiny hot star. So if you assume the same size objects, then the hotter one emits more radiation at every wavelength. So we claim this is going to be a green-blue star here, and yet it's emitting way more red light than the cool star did. This value on the curve for the middle star here is much higher than the red value for the cool star. But we don't say this star looks red to us. Why not? Well, we're not comparing this value to this value. We're comparing, out of the colors you can see, which color is the most prominent. And it peaks right here in the middle, or close to the blue. And so you would not call this a red star because, relatively speaking, within the range of the visible light for this star, it emits less red than it does the other colors. And so you perceive it as probably a blue star, maybe kind of a greenish blue star. So, point number one, this curve is always above this curve, and likewise, this curve is always above this curve. But point number two is, where does the peak go? There's the peak of the 3,000 Kelvin black body. There's the peak of the 6,000 Kelvin black body. There's the peak of the 12,000 Kelvin black body. Do you notice the march of the peaks as the objects get hotter and hotter? The peak moves to the smaller wavelength. And that's important. I mean, that's the other half of the reason why they look different colors. This peaks in the infrared. If you could see infrared, you wouldn't call this a red star. You'd call it an infrared star if you could see it. But since you can only see these colors right here, you see more red than blue, you'd call this a red star. This star emits more red than this one does, but it's not a red star because it emits more blue than red. This star emits a whole bunch more purple than red, even though it emits more red than the other star did. That doesn't matter. What matters is the difference between this and this in the range that you can see. So you would call this a purple star, except for our eyes do not respond as well to purple as they do to blue. This is a human deal now, not a physics deal. Our human eyeballs do not respond or not sensitive to purple like they are to blue. So it's really difficult to see purple, especially at night. And so we tend to call things, you know, the blue is a lot brighter. It looks, our eyes are more sensitive to it. So we don't talk about purple stars. We talk about blue stars. But its peak is not even in the visible at all either, like this one wasn't. This peak of this curve is over here in the ultraviolet. But you'd still call it a blue star or a violet star because of that. So back to the question, where would our sun go? Well, it's hotter than this star, but cooler than this star, so it has to go in between them, everywhere in between them. But the peak also needs to be between the two peaks. So the peak can't be over here. It needs to be this direction of this peak. And it can't be over this far. It's got to be this direction of this peak. So the peak would be somewhere, it's actually pretty close to this value anyway. 5,800 is close to 6,000. So it's going to peak right there in the yellow-green, and it's going to be below this curve everywhere. Because our sun peaks in the yellow-green, we see a yellow star. It also kind of emits a lot of red. I mean, when it peaks right in the middle, it's true that we get a little more yellow than the other colors, but at the peak, it's almost like we're getting a lot of all of them, and there's not a big ratio difference like there is here. That's twice as much purple as red. This is twice as much red as purple. But if it peaks right there in the yellow-green like our sun does, you're actually getting a lot of all of the colors, and you probably even actually say it's white more than you would yellow. Even though it peaks in the yellow-green, it really actually looks white. Okay, how are we doing on time? Let's take stock here and see how we're doing. The questions on our list of topics to discuss today is black bodies and black body radiation. It's one of those clouds on the horizon. There's two parts to our discussion. One is, do we now understand what black bodies are, why they aren't black? Maybe Deb's question has been answered as to why we care about them. But then the second part of the question is, why is it a cloud on the horizon? What is there to resolve? What's the issue? So first part of the question, does anybody have any remaining issues, any lingering doubts about what black bodies are, why they aren't black, and anything about this diagram we've just been looking at for quite some time? Any questions about that?
Somehow in the back of my mind, I have everything that we experience is a black body. Is that true or not?
No. If you see colored objects in the room, it's because different colors of light are reflecting off of the object into your eye. And because it's reflecting light, it's not a black body.
Right, but doesn't everything, because it's in motion, have radiation associated with it?
What's in motion?
Well, the kinetic energy with...
The atoms?
Yes.
I think I'll answer yes to that question. Maybe those of you that are in my physics for scientists and engineers class might recall the diffraction gratings we used yesterday to see specific wavelengths of light emitted by different gases. And you might say, how does a black body emit all of these colors, a whole continuous band of them? Yeah, it peaks at a certain color, but it's emitting all of the colors. How does it do that? And Deb's actually got the answer to that. The molecules are jiggling, jostling. It's a solid body. If it were a thin gas, it would not be a black body with a continuous spectrum. It would be a line spectrum with specific emission lines that are particular to that element that we saw in our gas tubes with the diffraction gradient. So Deb's right, to physically realize something like this with a continuous emission spectrum, you need lots of atoms packed tightly together that can then emit all of the different colors. Does that address your issue that you brought up, Deb? Is that what you were after?
I think so.
Okay.
I guess in reading or somewhere way back in the archives of my brain, I had somehow imagined that everything was a black body because of this kinetic energy, because we're not all, you can never achieve absolute zero. So
well,
that was my thinking.
I agree with portions of that statement. I agree that we are all made of atoms that are jiggling and jostling. But I wouldn't agree that we're all equally good approximations to a black body. First, I'd say there aren't any ideal black bodies anyway. Even the sun isn't a perfect black body, and even your little cavity that you've made with your hands might leak in a little bit of light, and so you're very hard-pressed to find a true ideal black body at all. But anything that reflects light, and most things do, is by definition not a black body. Now, some things might be better approximations to a black body. For example, let me push this a little bit. That little rod that our astronomy teacher heats up over the Bunsen burner, is it a black body? Well, when it's cold, no, it reflects light and you can see it. So, you know, black bodies, when they're cold, are supposed to be black. And it's not. It looks like a ball of metal. So it's not a good black body when it's cold. When you heat it up over the Bunsen burner, it starts to glow red, and you heat it even more and it starts to glow white. Eventually it melts, so you don't do it that far. But then it starts to act like a black body when it's emitting and radiating. A further point on that, though, is are we black bodies? And you'd say, of course not, because light's reflecting off of our faces into the other person's eyes. You see me because light hits me and then bounces into your eye. I see you the same way. So we're reflecting light, which means we're not black bodies. So we don't even have to ask if we glow. No, we are, but so this is maybe the point Deb's trying to make. We do still kind of glow. We glow according to our temperature. I said earlier that black bodies are black if they're cold. But back to this diagram one more time, Marty, on the Elmo here. 3,000 is pretty hot, and it's the lowest thing on the chart here. What if you talked about something that was only room temperature? 300 Kelvin. What would its curve look like? Would it be emitting zero light? No, but it would be emitting very little light. The curve has to be below this lowest one, by a long ways. And where would the peak of it be? Way over here in the long wavelength. So you need a curve that's everywhere below this one, and it's going to peak way over here for an object that's at room temperature, that's behaving like a black body. Well, you're a little warmer than room temperature, but okay, you're in the same ballpark. Do you glow? Well, kind of from what I said early on, black bodies are black if they're cold. Well, they glow a little bit. Do you glow? Yeah, a little bit. You do glow a little bit. You might not think so. You turn the lights off, shut all the windows, you can't see each other, you say, man, you're not glowing. I don't see you. You must not be shining because of your temperature. But why is that? Because the curve is so low, and because the peak of it is way, way, way over in the infrared. Can you see people in infrared? The answer is yes. Yeah. Night goggles. The military uses them all the time. You need to see things at night. You put on these military night goggles, and you can see things because of their temperature, including people. You can see people in dark rooms because the people glow. In that sense, they're acting a little bit like a black body. They're emitting radiation based on their temperature. It's very little and it's very long wavelength, but it's still acting a little bit like a black body. So maybe that's what Deb is referring to. You can see that if you have the right instrumentation. Your natural eyesight does not respond to infrared. So you don't see it with your eyes. It looks dark. You don't see people in dark rooms. But you put on those goggles and you can. By the way, there are two separate kinds of night vision goggles. One works on infrared, and the other just magnifies extremely low light levels. That second kind, if the room were truly black and no light sources, wouldn't see it. But the infrared might still pick up a warm body in there. The other kind, though, just magnifies light that's so weak that you normally wouldn't be able to detect it and magnifies it. So there are two kinds of night goggles. All right, part B of the question is, now that we kind of understand what black body radiation is and what it's all about and why we care about it, the part B is, why is it a problem? Why is it one of these classical physics dilemmas that kind of lead to the modern physics of the 20th century? And the answer is, in your book on the last page there, 18 near the top, it says that, well, let's kind of read some of this together. It's possible to understand classically the spectrum, both at the low frequency end and at the high frequency end, but no single theory could account for the entire spectrum. When the most modern theory of the day, and they talk a little bit about it, and the Rayleigh-Jeans equation, those two guys I mentioned earlier, applied to the problem, the result left an infinite emissivity or energy density for high frequencies. Back to the ELMO one more time, Marty. So the Rayleigh-Jeans equation predicts that these curves don't bend back down in the ultraviolet region toward the zero wavelength. They actually go up asymptotically toward infinity. And the theory, the equation, predicts infinite emissivity over here in the ultraviolet. And that's why in your book, in the margin, it's got this big bold little tab there in the margin, ultraviolet catastrophe. This is a catastrophe because we're emitting infinite amounts of energy in the ultraviolet region of the spectrum. Well, we know that bodies don't really do that. We don't see infinite amounts of energy coming off. We can even put infrared or ultraviolet detectors on them and see that it's finite. In fact, as you go clear down to close to zero wavelength, these bend all the way back down and approach zero. So experimentally, we can see what this does. And by the way, this graph is not a graph of the classical theory. This graph is a graph of the modern theory, which matches identically with the graph of experimental data. The experimental data curves really do bend back down, and the modern theory, the one we were able to fix up with modern physics, predicts this precisely. What did we have to do to the Rayleigh-Jeans classical equation to make those curves bend back down and come down to zero at zero wavelength? What did we have to do to the equation? Max Planck fiddled with the equation in the year 1900, fiddled and fiddled, just kind of playing around, and he said, well, what if I stick in another constant in there? Just I'll call it H, and I'll stick it in there and see what it does to the equation. He did that, and it made the curve bend over perfectly. It solved the mathematical issue. Great, you say. What's the problem? Why can't classical physics be happy about this? The reason classical physics couldn't account for this or couldn't comprehend this, and why 1900, even before Einstein's miracle year, is deemed to be the beginning of modern physics, is because Max Planck stuck that H in that equation, and that H says that energy comes in chunks. That ultraviolet light comes in packets that have a certain amount of energy in them, and no fractions thereof. The way we fixed up the equation and made the experiment match exactly with the theory, or vice versa, made the theory match exactly with the experiment, is by throwing in this idea that energy comes in chunks. And that is not a classical idea. It's the beginning of quantum mechanics. And we will see H many times in equations to come. Maybe till you're sick of it. That's all I have to say about Chapter 1. Do you have anything else to say about Chapter 1? We're almost out of time. Let me kind of wrap up here by maybe giving a little bit of a view into the future about where we're headed. Chapter 1 was an intro chapter, and we maybe only should have taken one day on it, but I think we've spent our time well. I hope you feel it's been beneficial. But if you think about the math of this semester, there's 15 weeks in the semester, and there's 16 chapters in the book, and the math doesn't work to our advantage, meaning we can't do one chapter per week. Furthermore, I said we'd emphasize some chapters more than others, so we don't want to have the same number of days on all of the chapters. Because we only meet twice a week, I think when we get into the middle chapters, like 8 through 11, we'll probably do them in one class period, two a week, for a couple of those, three or four of those chapters in the middle. That should do two things. That should allow us to squeeze 16 chapters into 15 weeks, and it should also allow us to spend a little extra time on relativity and quantum mechanics where we want to spend some extra time. So, we've spent a whole week already. You've been through a week of class now. Congratulate yourselves. On chapter 1, which is just an intro, and there wasn't even any homework. So we really need to kind of press ahead and go a little bit faster. I want to spend extra time in chapter 2, but not too much time, because we've got to be worried about the end of the semester. So for next time, definitely read chapter 2. You don't need to read chapter 3 quite yet. We won't be moving off of chapter 2 probably for 2 class days and maybe 3. It kind of depends on how it goes. But at least read chapter 2. And there's no reason in the world why you can't get a start on the homework. Maybe you won't be able to do them all until we talk about it or chat about them. But feel free to at least look at them and try a couple. I do have a solutions manual for the homework problems. And I am not at all bashful about letting you look in it. I don't want you to just come in and say, it's time to do my homework, it's due in an hour, I'd like to copy the whole assignment out of your book. That wouldn't go over very well. But if you come in and say, I've worked on this problem for 45 minutes, I think I'm spinning my wheels or I'm stuck, give me a hint or a clue, or maybe you'll come in and say, I think I've solved it, but I want to make sure. I'll be happy to either sit down with you and work through some of it or give you some hints or send you in the right direction or let you look in the answer book. So come by and see me if you get stuck on any problems. For our distant students, the same thing applies, except I'm not sure how I'd get the answer book to your face. Maybe I'll scan something and email a PDF or fax or something, but of course you have the same rights as anyone else in the class. So I'm fairly free with the answer book if it's going to help you learn. That's all I have. See you next time. That'd be next Tuesday. Across the hall.
Do you have the ISBN for the solutions manual?
Well, it's the instructor solutions manual, and they won't give it to you unless you're teaching the course.